Again, let me tell you what a pleasure it is to be with you. I look forward to this time that we could spend together. It's been several years ago that this was put together. Amy keeps asking me, how in the world did you get a meeting at New Caney? I'm telling her, I don't know. I'm here. Look forward to the opportunity we have to be together this week. It's down now. Well, we will just get started, and maybe it'll get going. 1 Peter chapter 1, if you would turn there with me. 1 Peter chapter 1. 1 Peter was written to Christians who were undergoing a time of persecution. That is made clear in verse 6 of chapter 1 when he talks about the various trials that they are going through. In chapter 4, he's going to talk about suffering as a Christian. And if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed in that, but let him glorify God in that. And so these Christians are going through persecution, and the implication is that whatever persecution they are going through at this time, it's going to get worse for them. And I think that helps us to appreciate what Peter says in chapter 1, verses 3 through 5, knowing that he is writing these things to people who are undergoing persecution. Read with me, beginning at verse 3. 1 Peter chapter 1, and verse 3 says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his abundant mercy has begotten us again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to an inheritance incorruptible and undefiled and that does not fade away, reserved in heaven for you who are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed in the last time." Helps us when he starts talking about inheritances and looking past the present to understand that the present for these people was not a very pleasant thing at all. And over again in 1 Peter, you see Peter trying to encourage them to not focus on the present and the problems that they are going through, the trials, the persecutions that they are going through, but rather to look forward to that time when the trials of life and the persecutions and all those things will be over, to look past the race and to the goal at the end of the race. I'm going to talk this morning about passion for heaven. The Hebrew writer makes the same point in Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. After chapter 11, he has talked about those Old Testament faithfuls who did those things by faith. And he mentions, of course, starting with Abel and going all the way down through the prophets of old at the end of the Old Testament who remained faithful to God even when they were going through all of the persecutions and trials, death and all of that they were going through. And all the people in between, Noah and Moses and David, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Sarah and all of those people. And so he mentions all those people. And then in chapter 12, beginning at verse 1, he begins to talk about these people to whom he is writing. And he says, get encouragement from those things that those people went through. You see, he says, we're running a race. We're all in this race. And we have this cloud of witnesses who is watching us. That's the chapter 11 people. They are watching us as we run that race. And he says, lay aside all the hindrances and the weights and all of those kinds of things and run with endurance the race that's set before you. Doing what? Looking to Jesus, the author and the finisher of our faith, who didn't dwell on what he was going through. Instead, went through what he was going through, the persecution, the death that he went through, in order that he might have the glory. He looked to the glory that was beyond the things that were happening to him at that moment. His encouragement is, let us do the same thing. Let us look to Jesus Christ, our example, and do those things as well. Peter writes to pilgrims in 1 Peter. In chapter 1 and verse 1, to the pilgrims of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. And then in chapter 2, in verse 11, he says, Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which wage war against the soul. That word pilgrim in the Greek describes the foreigner who leaves his homeland and he goes and he lives in a foreign land among a bunch of natives there. But he lives kind of as one of them, or at least in the same place, although he does not totally attach himself there because he is not attached there like the natives are. His home is somewhere different. That's the Greek word. And Peter says that's what you are. Now, the argument, I think, is well made that the pilgrim of the dispersion in chapter 1 and verse 1 that he describes these people as being pertains to to this earth. They were away from Jerusalem. They were away from Palestine, and they were living as a result of this great dispersion of the Jews. They were living in these places among the Gentiles. But that passage over there in chapter 2 and verse 11, it seems to me, is bringing this to a spiritual point. The pilgrim and the sojourner there is not just the person who has left their home in Palestine, who maybe had lived in Jerusalem, but now they're living somewhere else. This is the person for whom living on earth is a pilgrimage, is a sojourn. They are not members, they are not resident, they are not natives to this land. They are simply pilgrims here who are living among the natives, those who have attached themselves to this earth, for whom earth is home. He says, you're pilgrims among them. This earth is not your home. Peter reminds us of the song that we sing, this world is not my home. I am just a passing through. And Jesus gives the significance of that in Matthew chapter 6, verses 19 and 20, when he says, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy, and where thieves break in and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. Jesus says, don't make this your home. Don't make this the place where you set down your residence and your heart is here and all of your passion is here, because this is not home. Keep looking to heaven as your home. Lay up your treasure there. Well, what does that mean, to lay up your treasure in heaven? Paul talks about that a little bit in 1 Timothy chapter 6. Turn over there to that passage when he writes to Timothy, and he says, you need to tell those people who are rich among you some things about the riches that you have. You need to tell them not to be so attached to these riches, not to trust in these things. Notice him in verse 17. He says, command those who are rich in this present age not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. Don't trust in riches. Why? Because riches are uncertain. They're part of living in an uncertain world. And he says, you don't attach yourself to those things. You tell people, don't get so attached to those things. Don't lay up your treasure here. But you keep trusting in God. What does that mean practically? Well, he says there, beginning at verse 18, let them do good, that they may be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share, storing up for themselves a good foundation for the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life. Verses 18 and 19 are an interesting contrast. What Paul tells Timothy is that we store up an eternal spiritual treasure by not storing up our temporary physical treasures. We lay up things for eternity by laying up spiritual things where our Father is, and not by laying up these uncertain things where we are pilgrims. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. The point is, as hard as it is for us to remember sometimes, our place in this world will come to an end, and it will come to an end sooner than we might think. In the Hebrew chapter 9, verse 27, the Hebrew writer says, "It is appointed for man to die once, and after this comes the judgment." Death is an appointment that we all have to face. He says, and then you face eternal judgment. Judgment will be the pronouncement of where we will spend eternity. Matthew chapter 25, verses 34 and 41. Jesus says there, he makes this contrast. There are those who are on his right, who are the faithful. Those who are on his left, who are the unfaithful. He says to those on his right, come into the house. Come into the place that has been prepared by the Father since the foundation of the world. That's salvation, eternal salvation. And then in verse 41, to those on the left, those who have not done what they ought to have done, he says, depart from me, you cursed, into the place that is prepared for the devil and his angels. You see, what he's saying there is that judgment will determine our eternal salvation. And notice what it will be based on in that passage. It will be based on what we have done with the things that we have. Have we helped others? Have we come to the aid of others? Now, he's not saying there that that's the only thing for which we will be judged, but he's saying that's an important thing. That we need to realize that part of what will determine our eternal judgment is how passionately we have lived on this earth caring for others. And so Peter tells those suffering Christians that they've been begotten again or born again, he says, to a living hope. When you see the adjective living, think of that which is not susceptible to death or to passing away. We're told in God's Word that our God is a living God, that Jesus is living bread, that salvation is living water, that Christianity is a living way, and that Christians are living stones in God's house. And now he tells us that Christians have a living hope. What that means is that our hope is not susceptible to death or to passing away. In fact, our hope is the answer to death. And he says it is founded on the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. He was raised to never die again, and so shall we. And so in verse 4, Peter tells us that this living hope of resurrection is to end our pilgrimage and to go home. Inheritance involves homeland. Pilgrims do not inherit the land that they are passing through. They inherit their homeland. They inherit the land of their fathers. Our living hope is to go home and to inherit the riches that our Father has for us. And I want you to notice what Peter says about this inheritance. The first thing that he says is it's incorruptible. It is, in Jesus' words, where moth and rust cannot destroy. It is where thieves cannot break in and steal. Not only that, he says, it is undefiled. There is no sin in heaven. There is nothing that is attached to the sin of this world that will pass into the heavenly existence that will cause it to be corrupted or defiled in any way. It can't be polluted. No sin and no things that sin produces will be there. It is incorruptible. It is undefiled, and he says it is eternal. It will not fade away. There are no calendars and clocks in heaven. Why? Because there are no years. There are no months. There are no days. There are no hours. There are no minutes. There are no seconds. Eternity is just that. It is eternal. It is not measured by time. And he says it is reserved in heaven. Heaven is the dwelling place of God, our Father. And our inheritance is a place in the presence of God. Jesus said in John 14, verses 2 and 3, near the end of his life, in the last week of his life, he tells his apostles that he is going away. And he says, I'm going away to prepare a place for you. Why? Because in my Father's house there are many dwelling places. He says, I go to prepare a place for you. He says, if I go to prepare a place for you, I will come again, that there I am, there you may be also. And so Peter says that the Christian is kept. He said he is kept for an inheritance with God. Kept is a military term. We use the term guard. In their society in that day, a city was as strong as the military garrison that was assigned to it. Some cities were not considered very important in the Roman Empire, and they didn't have a Roman garrison there. And so they were constantly susceptible to being defiled and destroyed. But in the really important cities in the Roman Empire, they kept a garrison, a military group. And according to the importance of the city, that was the strength of the military that was there. And there were some places that were virtually impenetrable, undestroyable, undefilable. Why? Because the power of the Roman military was there. It guarded it. It kept it, in Peter's word there. But he says, we have an inheritance prepared for us, kept for us in heaven, reserved in heaven. Not by human military might is it reserved or kept, by the power of God. But he said it is the power of God through faith. It's not unconditional. Being kept by the power of God for an inheritance in the after a while is conditional upon our faith and what we do with that faith, the proof of that faith, through our obedience to Jesus Christ. But his point is, this place is reserved for us, and it is reserved and we are kept by the power of God. That's Romans 8, those last number of verses, isn't it? Where he talks about that no one can separate us from the love of God. If we are faithful to Him, His promise is that He will be faithful to us. If we keep faith in Him, He will keep us, and nothing can take it away from us. That is our assurance of eternity in heaven. And so the Christian's steadfast hope is of an eternal inheritance in heaven. Have you ever inherited something that you just really didn't care for at all? You know, I've met people who receive things for an inheritance that they just would rather not have received. In fact, I've met people who have turned down their inheritance because it was going to be more trouble for them to take that thing than it was going to be to just say, no, thank you. They just give it to somebody else. There have been horror stories about things that people have inherited. And so our question is heaven worth it? Peter says heaven is our inheritance. How are we going to look at that? Are we going to look at it as something that's kind of a thanks but no thanks kind of thing? That's what a lot of people do. They don't see the value of going to heaven. And so they just turn it down. They never express faith in Jesus Christ. They never are obedient to the gospel of Christ. They never make up their minds to be faithful to the Lord. And so we ask the question, why should we be passionate about an inheritance in heaven? Well, the passage that was read for us just a few moments ago, Revelation chapter 22, verses 1 through 5, is John's answer to that. It is, I believe, John's apocalyptic vision of heaven. Six things, he says, will be perfect there. Eternal life, he says, is the perfection of life. Why? Because the water of life is flowing from the throne of God there. There is the perfection of life and there is the perfection of nourishment. Why? Because the tree that produces 12 kinds of fruit, it is blooming all year long, providing nourishment for the people of God. It is the perfection of healing. The leaves of the tree, he says, are for the healing of the nations. Not that people come in there sick or that they get sick while they're there. The point is, there is no sickness there. There is no need of healing because you are healed when you go in by the leaves of that wonderful tree. There is rest there. The curse of sin that brought toil to mankind is gone. And so there is no toil. There is eternal rest. And he says there's fellowship with God. He says, we will see God's face. See God's face. That fact is mentioned a number of times, that heaven is the place where we see the face of God. And I think probably we don't appreciate, we kind of read over that sometimes and think, okay, well, that means, you know, kind of we're going to just see Him face to face. There's something very important about seeing the face of God. The Bible writers place a premium on that. That there is something beautiful and majestic and glorious about the face of God, and something that we could never do in this life and live, we will be able to do for eternity in heaven. See the face of God, have perfect fellowship with Him. And then there is the perfection of glory. He says you don't need a lamp in heaven. You don't need the sun and the moon in heaven. Instead, the light of heaven is the unadulterated glory of God. What is Revelation 22, verses 1 through 5? Does it kind of sound familiar to you a little bit? Some of the words in there, tree of life, water of life, those kinds of things. I want to suggest to you that what Revelation 22 is Eden restored. The Bible comes full circle in Revelation 22. It begins with the first man and woman placed in Eden, in really the first paradise, the physical paradise. And God walks in that garden. And the tree of life is in that garden. Rest is in that garden. There's no labor in that garden. Man lost it because of his sin. And the rest of the Bible is about how God worked to restore Eden to humankind. In Revelation chapter 22, it's completed. Eden is restored. The tree of life is back. The healing is back. The rest is back. The perfection that we have not been able to see since the Garden of Eden is back. Sin is gone, and Eden is back. But I want to suggest to you, not just back, but better. I was teaching the book of Revelation here a while back, and Foy Vincent, he was the preacher at West Allen before I was there, and he stayed on as one of the elders, and he was sitting in that class, and I made the point that Revelation 22 was Eden restored, and he came up to me afterwards, and he goes, you know, it's just not restored. It's a whole lot better than what Adam and Eve had in heaven, and he's right. You look at that passage and you wonder, well, is there really going to be this water coming out of this throne? Is there really going to be this tree and real fruit? I don't know. That's a great answer, isn't it? I don't know how literal this is. But I tell you, it doesn't make any... I don't have to know. Because it's better than literal. It is God describing perfect life. Perfect nourishment. Perfect healing. Perfect rest. Perfect fellowship with God. What does all that mean? Well, in Revelation 7, 16 through 17, and 21, 3 through 4, it means no more of what plagues mankind on earth. I'm 63 years old. And I'll tell you, there are things plaguing me today that I never dreamed would plague me when I was 13 years old. This body's wearing out. And it's wearing out pretty quickly. I go to bed at night and I get up the next morning and I've got a new pain. And I don't know what it was because all I was doing was sleeping. And the next day, something else is hurting. Trials and tribulations. And I'll tell you, life's been good for me. I've not suffered near as much as I know a number of people in this audience have suffered. Why? Because we live in a fallen world and we're attached to it. Our bodies are attached to it. We have pains. We have sorrows. We have illnesses. All those things are part of life. And so Revelation 7, 16 and 17, 21, 3 through 4 tells us, here's the thing about your inheritance in heaven. No more hunger. No more thirst. No more too hot. No more too cold. That's Revelation 7. I'll tell you, if he stopped right there, it'd be worth it, wouldn't it? not being hungry anymore, not being thirsty anymore, not being too hot if you live in Houston or too cold if you live in Dallas. It gets better in chapter 21. No more pain. No more sorrow. No more death. Would you like to live in a place where there was no more pain, no more sorrow, and no more death? And he really wraps it up when he says, no more tears. All these things, and I think that's probably what all of us can together appreciate, have in common. All of us may not have felt the same pains. All of us may not have experienced the same sorrows. All of us have not experienced the loss of loved ones in death as others. That's all not equal, but I'll tell you what is probably pretty much equal with us. We've all shed those tears. This earth is a crying place. And John says, in heaven, no more tears. Is it a place that we can be passionate about? Absolutely. I'll tell you, if this is not something to be passionate about, then I don't know what is. And our passionate goal needs to be to get to heaven. And I'll tell you, in the world that we live in and the bodies that crave the things of this earth, we cannot remind ourselves of that more often. My goal is not to be the richest person in the cemetery. My goal is not to kind of exercise my way and eat my way to a point where I'm the most healthy person that they ever said. I don't know why he died. My goal is to get to heaven. Through the pains, through the sorrows, through the tears. To get to heaven. I tell you, the more tears you shed, the more heaven ought to be all to you. I could not appreciate heaven at 13 as much as I appreciate it now at 63. And if the Lord allows me to live till I'm 83, I cannot appreciate it now nearly as much as I will then. I want to go to heaven. I passionately want to go to heaven. And I hope that you do too. Mark 12, verses 30 and 31 says we have a twofold duty. One of the scribes, one of the lawyers, comes to Jesus Christ and he wants to know, what is the great commandment? Of all the commandments, what is the great one? And Jesus says, the first one is to love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. I'll tell you what that is. That's what's going to get us to heaven's perfection. You love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. And I mean truly love Him and live your life evidencing that love, and you're going to go to heaven when this life is over. But he adds to that, he says the second one is love your neighbor as yourself. He says that's important. That's the second law upon which everything stands. Every other law stands. The first law gets us to heaven's perfection. The second law helps ease earth's imperfections. You see, it is important for us to ease the pain and the sorrow and the hunger and the thirst that is associated with this life. Go back over there to Matthew chapter 25 and that image of judgment day when the sheep are separated from the goats, when those who are righteous are on the right and those who are unrighteous are on the left. In verse 34, he says to those on his right who have been righteous, he says, "Inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me food. I was thirsty and you gave me drink. I was a stranger and you took me in. I was naked and you clothed me. I was sick and you visited me. I was in prison and you came to me." Then the righteous will answer him saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? When did we see you a stranger and take you in, or naked and clothe you? Or when did we see you sick or in prison and come to you?" And the king will answer and say to them, "Assuredly I say to you, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these my brethren, you did it to me." Again, this is not the complete formula for salvation. Jesus is making a point here. And the point is, if you have not loved your neighbor as yourself, then everything else that you have done has been for naught. A sideline goal of ours is to ease the pain and the suffering and the sorrow that is part of this earthly existence. But it is important for us to understand that we will never, ever eliminate all those things. We can feed as many people as our budget allows, and guess what? There's still going to be hungry people in this world. We can come up with all the marvelous things to do for people who are sick. And guess what? There's still going to be sick people in this world. We can encourage people to proper diet and exercise, and they can follow our advice, and we can feed them the right things and all that kind of stuff. And guess what? People are still going to die. Why is that? Because this earth, no matter what we do, it will never, ever be heaven. And so we must be careful that we do not make it our goal to make this earth our heaven. Our goal is not to make earth heaven. Our goal is to get to heaven. And as my good friend D. Bowman says, if you miss heaven, you've just missed it all. Whatever else you've done in this life, if you don't get to heaven, you just missed it. You've missed what life is all about. Make heaven your goal. And make it your goal with passion. Be passionate about getting to heaven. Because heaven is a prepared place by a passionate God for those who have passionately prepared themselves to go. And I ask you this morning, are you prepared? Jesus said a long time ago, "He who believes and is baptized will be saved." You know what he said different in the last 2,000 years? Not a thing. The same thing that would save you and prepare you, get you at least started on the road to heaven 2,000 years ago, is what gets you started today. And the pleadings of men like Peter and the Hebrew writer to get yourself prepared, to obey the gospel, be faithful unto death, is the same plea today. Obey the gospel if you haven't. Do whatever's necessary to make yourself right with God if you're not. Be passionate about your home in heaven. Can we help you to do that this morning? If we can, let us know how we can. But coming forward right now, while together we stand and sing.